Hi, welcome to the Zero Knowledge Podcast. And today we're going to be talking about decentralized storage once again. This is sort of the second part in a three-part series that we're doing on the topic. And in this episode, what we want to actually look at is some of the different solutions out there, kind of do a survey of what's around right now. But I think before we start, we wanted to have a bit of a conversation about like why these things are coming out at all. So why right now are things coming out? So as I was reading a few articles about this, I noticed that there seems to be like three main points that a lot of these solutions are selling. They basically say that they can be cheaper, they can provide better security against data being shared or lost, and that they could potentially improve speed. And I think obviously, different solutions might highlight different parts of this, but I think we could start maybe from there.
Yeah, I mean, the natural starting topic is what are we trying to do with this? Like, why have this decentralized storage at all? And like, what problem does it aim to solve? And the three things that you mentioned, I think, is a good way to dig in. There's obviously more. It's always more, but I think these are the core of what's trying to be accomplished. And then there's some downsides to this, like you said, and we can look at some different versions out there and talk a little bit maybe about what to look out for when you see something new in this space.
Cool. Let's start with the first thing then. So the claim is decentralized storage will be cheaper. And it's interesting because I've actually heard rebuttals to that. But what do you think, Fred?
I think it's an interesting thing to think about. So it's definitely not clear-cut, right? Storage is incredibly cheap, and you have economies of scale, like Amazon is buying 50% of the world's hard drives or whatever, so they can get a huge discount on storage. But at the same time, Amazon employs thousands of people. I mean, they build a system that then employs thousands of developers maintaining that system. Those developers will need to be paid. They need to add a healthy profit margin on top. Now, profit margins in the storage world are incredibly thin, but they still have to be healthy enough to like build a business. In this decentralized world, the concept is that you don't pay developers to maintain the system. You build the system once, and then you just have storage providers that you pay. And essentially, their profit margin is they need to be able to pay for hard drives, network, etc., but not much else. So the fact that it's intended to be like normal people running their own computers on this network also kind of says that maybe the intention is not to have a huge profit margin and be like competitive, but to build a healthy ecosystem.
Do you think some of this will be also like at the beginning it isn't necessarily cheaper, but later on it becomes cheaper when we get economies of scale? Or do you think it is like right off the bat, like those margins are gone and therefore it'll be cheaper?
So what I think will happen is that it will appear to be a lot cheaper, but in reality, you're actually trading off cost for something else. So with Amazon, for instance, you get whatever they have, 7/9 of availability or redundancy and good performance. Like they have data centers everywhere, high network speeds, high drive speeds, high reliability. You get a super top quality service. And actually, in a lot of their services, you can trade off. For instance, if you put stuff on Amazon Glacier, you're trading availability for money. Like you're saying, I don't need to access my data right away, so I'm willing to pay less to not have that immediate access. There's reduced redundancy storage on S3 that you can reduce this 7/9 or whatever they have of redundancy to something less and pay less for it. So what we'll see in the decentralized world is essentially a lot of these companies are already marketing like their cheapest possible contracts, which means like you store it on one computer or two computers, and like you don't have at all the same performance guarantees that you have from Amazon, but you're also paying way, way less. So I think walking this path of like what is actually value for money is hard. It's not just looking at the bottom line, like it's looking at the bottom line and what you get for it. And people are like notoriously bad at doing this, even in the traditional centralized storage world.
You've also mentioned like in a previous conversation that we had about this, where it's, you have a lot more options to customize. And so in a way, like you kind of just said here, where it's like the value for money, you can actually potentially just like get exactly the configuration that you're looking for, something that wouldn't necessarily be offered in these larger solutions.
Like a good part of the world doesn't need like S3 level performance for whatever they're doing. Mm-hmm. Like if you are just taking backups and uploading somewhere, you don't need the same performance characteristics as Instagram. Having that flexibility and the full configurability from a single service is, I mean, that's value in itself. Where right now you might switch around to different services for different properties and depending on what you want to pay and what you want to do. Making all that into one service is obviously a value add as well.
So then the next one we had here is security. Security has two ideas here. One is security, i.e. your data is protected and it's private. And the other is security against that data being lost. There is an argument that in a decentralized setup that it is safer. And I'm curious about that one. I mean, I think we all understand that with a centralized organization, you can always have, you basically just need keys to that castle, and then you actually do have access to everything. At the same time, there are a lot of safeguards against having keys to that castle. But then I wonder, like, if it's decentralized, is there not more potential for attacks? Is there not more potential for data to be lost?
Definitely. So I think this goes back almost to a closed source versus open source conversation, where the argument for open source is that it's transparent and it's inspectable. I can audit the code and I can say this is safe for what I need it to do. Not many people are actually able to make that determination though. So there is that trade-off of like, do you trust a company that their closed source black box behaves the way that you think it does and that it's safe? There are centralized storage solutions that provide end-to-end encryption. I mean, you could end-to-end encrypt your storage on S3, for instance. I mean, you just encrypt it before you send it to them. So on the encryption side, I wouldn't say that there's any clear security benefits. But on the sort of acting in an open system versus a closed black box, you never have any guarantee that Amazon doesn't, declare bankruptcy tomorrow and shut down all their servers. It's very unlikely. But you have no guarantees. And in an open system, you have some guarantees around how this system will operate.
And this is a bit of like the redundancy factor, I guess, because there's many, many entities holding many pieces of data instead of one entity basically holding all of the data, that if something happened to one of these, like in the decentralized case, if something happened to one of these entities or actors, then there's a ton of other actors potentially holding your data. Except that when you actually dig into a lot of these systems, a lot of the decentralized storage systems, it's not necessarily that you have every file on every computer.
No, that would be hugely inefficient. I mean, then you're kind of rebuilding Ethereum that is like 100% replicated state machine. and like saying that everyone stores everything isn't going to work. So at some point, you have to draw limits, and it seems that a lot of the solutions that we've been looking at and we might talk about later is you have some sort of contract base. So you're saying, like, I'm going to get this contract from one of the peers, and they promise to store my data for this long at this price. And then your strategy to increase availability and increase your security is getting multiple contracts for the same data. And it's mm-hmm. essentially then up to you to say, how many people are you willing to pay for to store this stuff for you? So you could theoretically have everyone on the network store your file. It's just going to cost a lot of money. Again, this goes back to this flexibility of, do I want one person that I trust to store it, or do I need multiple people, or how many people do I need? And none of this is actually very well defined in what the expected system strategy is. So I think that's a big thing that's still to be worked out.
And then our last one was speed. And I have it written speed ?
that's a big questionable one, if you can actually improve speed.
So the argument here is the reason that there is any speed delay in a centralized example is that it's not that the data is actually in super close proximity to you at all times. There are actually large data centers in certain regions, and so it'll be faster than, say, you were getting everything from North America and you're living in Europe. But it's not that you're getting everything from down the street. And so that's what I've always understood as the argument for decentralized as giving you the opportunity for higher speeds.
Yeah.
But does that really happen?
to some degree. I mean, if you look at the BitTorrent network, it has millions of peers, and it is actually a very well distributed network, much more distributed than say S3, mm-hmm. but it's there are content distribution networks who make it their business to have a server in every major city on the world. So they mm-hmm. still don't have millions of servers everywhere, but they have a server in every major city, and at that point, how much of a performance gain can you actually get? So I think it's more about you replicate the storage properties of something like S3 with the distribution properties of something like a CDN. So you're kind of combining both of those technologies and potentially having a gain there. But I think when talking about speed and performance, it's useful to separate the network speed from the drive speed, the performance of the server. So Amazon will have top quality servers. It's their incentive to provide the best service because that's what they're being paid for. So they'll have good servers with good drive speed and whatever else. An individual actor on this market doesn't necessarily have any incentive to provide a good server that will serve this up. Even though they might be closer to you, the question again becomes there, what's the trade-off between proximity and actual server performance, how fast you're able to send this file. And then it's useful to talk about the average users, the average peer in a P2P network's network speed is not going to be that good, right? Mm-hmm. Not that many people have fiber, and even those that do have 100 megabit fiber, whereas Amazon has terabytes of bandwidth. So you can pretty much always max out your own personal private network connection speed through Amazon. But if you actually put things on a P2P network, BitTorrent works because it pools the network bandwidth of multiple peers so that you can still exceed the speed of any single peer. But I mean, many of these solutions that are being proposed now, they don't have that torrenting kind of aspect. Some do, not all. And so then the question is, if you're limited to the speed of a single peer, everything will be dependent on that single peer's connectivity. Now, if they're in the same house as you and it's LAN, it's, gigabit or 10 gigabit or whatever, it's probably great, the question, will that happen? Probably not. Maybe, but probably not.
We were also talking a little bit about the downside, generally, of decentralized storage. And the most obvious right now is the inferior UX, just because these centralized storage companies have been, I mean, that's kind of one of the things they swooped in. We talked about this last episode, actually. They came in with these really clean, easy interfaces that kind of anybody could easily set up. You didn't have to have deep technical knowledge to be able to use this kind of stuff. And so, yeah, they kind of were able, in a way, to replace the old P2P, and people were still happy. Now, with the new decentralized solutions, you see... I mean, I think people are aware of the fact that, I mean, it's existed for already a couple of years. They're aware of the fact that the UX could be better, and the UX should actually start really competing with these, like the big professional centralized services. So I'm going to mention that as a current downside, but kind of like in the process of being fixed and is quite fixable.
I think that's, a fair statement to make. There are certain things that are better than others, but, I mean, in general, it's still a very, like, geeky type of sphere where you kind of need to enjoy the bad UX a little bit to, feel like you're hacking on something or feel like you're hardcore. And then, but then, like, that doesn't work for most people, so... There needs to be improvements made on that to make it actually pleasant to use by a normal person.
But then there's some other... The other big downside that you kind of mentioned here was this, there's no existing reputation market. So there's no... Like, whereas all of these larger companies, you know what you're dealing with. You know that there's... I mean, there's... It's very important that they maintain those reputations. Whereas if you're dealing with a decentralized one, there's nothing that... really can guide you right now.
So going back to that contract model, you sign a contract with someone and say that they're going to store my file for 6 months, but they have very little incentive to actually hold that contract. There's no discussion at all about what a legal repercussion to that might be, I don't think there ever will be any. So we're going to have to rely on reputation markets to say that, you know, this... person has stored, you know, files for this long in this much space and have like completed this many contracts or something to say that this peer is reputable. And if there is no such thing, then there's no disincentive for them to just go, I'm bored with this, I'm just going to shut down my node and not fulfill the contract. So that's... again, like you always have to plan for that, obviously, even if they don't willfully shut down their node, they might have a power outage or something. So again, it's back to availability and redundancy and all that kind of stuff. You need to pay to have multiple contracts, otherwise you might get screwed. But like you're saying, these big actors, they have a big reputation with a huge incentive to not besmirch that in any way. So if they lose your data in any way, they're like, holy shit, we're fucked. Whereas if, you know, some random person on this decentralized network loses your data, no one knows or cares.
So now we're going to, we have a list here of a couple companies they're all kind of trying to tackle these points we just raised in different ways. The ones we want to look at are companies like Storage, Sia, Filecoin, MadeSafe. We do have a few others on the list that we maybe didn't go as deep into, like Cryptic and Swarm, which we can talk about maybe a little bit. And we also have here some, these are not really data storage, they're more like database companies.
I think it's an interesting distinction to make between data storage and database. Ultimately, it's the same thing, you're storing data. It's just that in one form, you're storing it slightly more structured, and the company or the goal of the company might be to create some query language or something like that for this data so that you can kind of automate things more. I mean, to any developer, the difference between a database and just pure raw data storage is kind of obvious, but from an implementation point of view and it gets muddled even more in this space because something like IPFS is content addressable storage, right? So
exactly.
if the content is a value, you get a key for it and then you have a key value pair and now you have a key value database on IPFS. So if you're just building a key value database, you know, how much better can you be than that? These companies usually have like a different approach to availability and redundancy and that kind of thing, because it, I don't know, they can have some different properties, I guess. But it's an interesting distinction. I think don't have to go into it any deeper than that. But
we maybe we do actually a show on just that, just on the database type companies. The ones we were thinking of here were Streamr, Bluezel, and BigchainDB. All right, so the first company that we kind of looked at was Storage. Storage is it's been around for a while, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's 2014.
I think that's a kind of recurring theme in this space. Some are really new, but some have actually been around for a long time. Like IPFS has been around for a super long time. Filecoin is the incentive layer on top and is kind of more recent, but Madesafe has been around for a super long time, yeah.
Totally. And I can totally imagine that these companies have also gone through iterations, like every startup, every tech company. But yeah, we're gonna try to cover some of their characteristics and maybe look at them through the lens of the stuff that we were talking about before, to see where it kind of ranks on performance. I think one of the other things that I'm thinking of as we're kind of going through this is if, like, providing decentralized storage is something you want to do. Like, this is where I'm trying, because this might be something I want to do. So I definitely want to, like, understand what does it mean as a user to actually participate in these networks. And, like, would a casual user be able to jump in and start playing with this stuff, or is it, like, really only for applications?
Yeah.
All right. So our first one was Storage. For those who are just listening, storage is it's missing the A and the E at the end, so it's S-T-O-R-J, Storage, one of these where they drop the vowels.
A startup name.
Classic. So the files in storage are encrypted, sharded, and each shard is stored on a different peer.
So I think that's actually a pretty common property of these systems, is this sharding action. So maybe it's useful to dig into what that actually means. So essentially, if you're uploading a file that's 100 megs, if you shard that into 10 shards, it's essentially just 10 pieces of that file that are 10 megabytes each. And then what storage does is it automatically shards it into, I don't know how many shards actually, but then stores these shards on different peers. So if one peer goes down, you're losing one part of the file. In traditional hard drive space, you have this thing called RAID, and there's different RAID strategies where, like, a fully replicated system, I think that's RAID 0, but then you have different algorithms to try to basically have redundancy over multiple drives without having to replicate everything 100%. So there's versions called striping and whatever else. And I'm running it on my NAS, and essentially I can lose one out of my four drives and not lose any data at all. So if I use the same storage algorithm, I could basically replicate my data such that one, like if I had data on four peers, one of them could go down and I wouldn't lose anything at all. And so sharding is actually a key piece in, like, being able to achieve a system like this.
Is sharding super different from, like, BitTorrenting? Like the little, like...
Not really. The way that BitTorrent works is that you... it's still content addressable, but you address the whole piece. You don't address a small piece of it. But when it's downloading, it's basically saying, can I have piece number X out of this content? I don't know
similar
how it varies.
Concept,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. It's a very similar concept. I mean, it could be identical in theory.
Huh.
I think their implementation is slightly different, but I mean, you could basically
do the protocol. It almost just It sounds a little bit like just a new name for it.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe I'm wrong. Just the way you described it, it sounded super, super similar.
I think the big difference is that in BitTorrent, the shards, the pieces are very small, and it's part of the protocol what the pieces, the size of the pieces are. Whereas in something like storage or other solutions, you may want much bigger pieces, so fewer shards. Or you want to have like a customizable amount of shards. So it shouldn't be bound to the protocol of what size these shards are.
Let's go back to storage then. So the company itself. So how is storage working?
It's operating on this contract basis as well. But what I think is interesting for them is that they say they're payment agnostic. So they're kind of saying you can plug storage into any blockchain. So you can have a Bitcoin storage, an Ether storage, a fiat storage, where you can choose to settle this contract that you're making with someone in whatever way you want. Practically, I think they're probably going to build something on Ethereum as their product, but then you could like apply the protocol agnostically to anything else. I think it's an interesting approach where they're taking kind of a protocol level approach to this rather than saying we're a set of smart contracts on top of Ethereum.
When in the context of performance, this is one of these examples we were talking about earlier where you could really choose and basically decide exactly your kind of custom requirements, and therefore you would actually get the exact performance for the buck that you want.
Yeah.
Right?
So it's because it's one of these systems that are contracts based, theoretically you should be able to fully customize the type of performance that you want. But I mean, some of this stuff goes back to implementation, though, because ultimately, if it's part of the contract that you can see where a pair is and that's reliable, that's another like thing that you can customize on the performance side. But if you can't see the location, you might up with three servers in India and you're in the US and it's not very performant at all, despite having many pairs. So it's sort of like when it comes to analyzing performance of any of these, it's really hard to say until we actually have a running system where, the network is what it's supposed to be.
And I'm wondering, you haven't tried storage yourself, have you?
I've not tried storage, but I've obviously worked a lot with IPFS.
Yeah.
I've tried Siacoin. I actually set up a miner for that at one point just to see what it was like. But I've not really tried any of the others. So MadeSafe, I'm not even sure if it's usable. Storage, I'm not even sure if it's usable either. Like if they have a public thing you can run.
Because I'm just curious, like again, from the sort of like somebody who wants to experiment with this stuff, like how complicated would this be actually to get going? MadeSafe, you just mentioned as well. MadeSafe is also one of the older, in the space. Well, by older, we mean like 3 years old or something like that. It's not like old, but definitely it's been in the storage space before. I think there was a lot of excitement and people looking at it. I know from reading about them back then and then reading about them now, it looks like they've changed quite a lot. Now, according to what they're releasing in terms of their comms, they actually aren't necessarily looking at having people be responsible for the storage, but rather like autonomous storage.
So yeah, what that means in practice, I'm not really sure, but that their pitch is interesting and it's something that kind of rings true. The proof is in the pudding at the end of the day, but they're kind of arguing that this contract-based thing is kind of stupid and that it should be computers fully autonomous network. You just start a computer and you start your node on that computer and then it handles everything else. So it kind of negotiates these contracts for you with the whole network, but there isn't a single pair that can change their prices individually. So the price is decided by the network as a whole, and like all the negotiation of where to send files and who stores what pieces and what it costs and what their availability and blah, blah, blah is determined by the protocol of this network. And I think that's an awesome idea. But again, I haven't seen any of this code, so I can't say like if it's going to work. I don't really know what the incentive structures are, because at the end of the day, if it's something that the network determines as a whole, you'll end up with issues like cost of running this on your machine is way, way cheaper in, say, China than it is in the US. So wouldn't that just mean that all peers essentially end up in China because that's the cheapest place to run? And so the network is enforcing this lowest common denominator property and outcompetes anyone that operates in a more expensive space.
It also sounds like it takes away that what we were talking about before, where like you could, because you could customize, you could actually get exactly what you want. It sort of sounds like here you don't have that.
Here they just kind of say you should want X, and therefore that's what you're gonna get.
But it also sounds a little bit like the UX might be a little bit easier. Like the whole thing might just be easier to set up, and like you said, like a lot more hands off, and that might be very appealing to a certain group of people as well.
For sure,
they have an incentivization structure planned. So they have something called the Safe Coin, which is set to be released in 2018. I think we did look at it, but it wasn't quite clear how it was going to operate. All that has been stated is it's not proof of work. So that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, my guess would be that it's some sort of proof of storage based thing like CL or whatever else. Like, basically, you mine by making storage space available, and the more storage space you make available, the more money you get.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
I actually, it's funny though, because like I've also heard proof of storage described as a form of proof of work. So I like that you could, that they were so almost interchangeable.
Right. I think there's a couple of different ways to talk about proof of storage. Like one thing is just like the kind of technical mathematical proof that you have stored something. And the other way is that it's where it's talked as a replacement of proof of work, or basically instead of devoting CPU power, you're devoting drive power. And there's other like proof of capacity. I don't know. There's like proof of memory usage, proof of like network capacity, and a couple of these other things where they're trying to exploit different resources than CPU power. And like they're all different, like worked out to a different degree of security. The drive space one seems to be running on a couple of blockchains and seems to be working well, so I have no reason to doubt that it works as a proof of work mechanism.
So when we asked ourselves about like performance, because it's not really out there, we actually don't have that much information on this, on MadeSafe, in terms of performance. But next up, we're going to talk about like kind of our favorite, one of the ones we know the most, you know the most. So IPFS, what does it stand for exactly?
Interplanetary File System.
Yeah, cool.
So I think, IPFS is a well-known entity. It's been around for a long time. It's been used by a lot of people. But the way to think about IPFS is just as a sort of networking layer where you have no other guarantee that any files will be stored other than by yourself. So if you start an IPFS node and you make a file available on that node, it's now available on the network. But if someone else downloads it, by default, I think it caches it for a certain amount of time. But there's this concept of pinning content. So another node can say, I want to pin this, making sure that it will always stay on their server as well. But it's up to the other individual actor to do that. Like, you can't say, I want someone else to pin my content. There's just no mechanism at all for that. And that's sort of what Filecoin aims to introduce, like being able to say, I want you to pin my content. And essentially you need some incentivization there, that like this person that is pinning your content needs to be paid. But just plain IPFS is you just think of it as you run your own web server kind of thing.
What is it mostly used for right now, actually?
So in our company, we use it in a couple of different ways for essentially doing off-chain storage. So you store some content on an IPFS node that you own, and then you put the content address on the blockchain. And like the guarantee you have is that the content address on the blockchain is guaranteed. Like you can never manipulate that in any way. So you can guarantee that whatever file you get is the one that was said to be on the chain. And we use this mostly in private and consortium networks, where you can guarantee that this person will be running this IPFS node, you know, as long as the network is running, because it's in their incentive to make the files available. But I've heard of a lot of other use cases where someone might run an IPFS node in their office and route all like NPM package downloads through it. So rather than, you know, downloading the whole internet every time you run NPM install, you download it from a local cache server. And you can do this with a cache server, like a traditional cache server. It's just way easier to set up an IPFS node. So it's like any dev can just start up an IPFS node and do this. But, you know, setting up a cache server that serves up the internal network, I mean, it's just kind of harder.
Do you know, like, how would you compare something like IPFS to Nutella? Like, have you ever thought of that comparison?
Not really, but I mean, it would be similar. I mean, it's
protocols without any, like, you can use them without, like, if you add an incentivization layer to either of those things, then it, like, IPFS and Nutella would just act as the protocol underlying it.
So I think, I mean, it's similar for sure. They both use DHTs for peer discovery, as far as I know. So, I mean, it's DHT plus content addressable storage. Mm. I don't know if Nutella is content addressable, though. I think it's just human discovery kind of addressable. Like if you connect to a node and you can get a file list from them, but you can't say, I want the file with this particular content. So I think that may be the difference.
Okay. So then the Protocol Labs are the creators of IPFS originally. And they have also, they've decided to create an incentivization layer in order to encourage people to actually store other people's data. We will probably be going a little deeper into Filecoin in another episode. So we don't need to go too deep into it in this, but maybe just to give a sense of it, like what really does that add to IPFS?
So it adds this ability of saying, I want X peers to store my content for me. And you don't necessarily need to run a node yourself to basically make that content available. So you can just say, I have some content. I want this amount of peers to make that available to the public and upload it to the network and have pay for that in some way.
And I think the other thing, you're speaking then from the user's perspective, but then there's also like, why would you, like right now having an IPFS node is cool if you have stuff that you're hosting, but there's nothing, you wouldn't actually like start one up for other people unless maybe you're friends with them and they're like, can you do that? And you'd be like, cool. But like,
you would have no incentive to ever run an IPFS node unless you plan on making stuff available. So now it will give you a reason to run a node yourself and participate in this network because you can get paid for it.
And I think, so right here though, I have this question. I've been asking this a lot, is like, how much can you really make with any of these solutions? And maybe we could talk about that at the end of this episode, but like, that's been a big question of mine. It's like, cause at first, I mean, I've been like, oh my God, this is so neat. You just like have storage and make some coin and it's like a universal basic income for everybody. If you have a hard drive,
right.
But when I've actually looked at some of the numbers that people have suggested, we're talking about like potentially very low margins for people.
Right.
And the only people who could really make a lot with this would be people running storage farms. Storage farms? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I mean, so if we can talk about this in the context of SIA, because that's the one I actually tried out myself. And SIA is very much like storage. It's contracts-based. It has its own blockchain, so it's not built on Ethereum. This blockchain is running. People are mining on it. And it does the same kind of encryption, sharding, blah, blah, blah. But I started up a miner. Went fine. I just mined on something, some hardware I had at home. Didn't make any money at all. I don't think I even made one coin, because you kind of need to join a pool as usual, and then they have payout limits and whatever. So I didn't make anything, but I started to look at then, like, it was reasonably easy to start up and seemed to work well. So I then looked into, okay, what would it take to actually be profitable? I have a server at a German like hosting provider that makes very, very cheap dedicated servers available to people. And you can buy extra hard drive space there. That's, you know, quite cheap actually. So I looked at like buying or renting then like 100 terabytes of storage and then deploying that on the network. And my profits would be something like a couple of bucks a day. So maybe, you know, 50 bucks a month or something. But of course, renting is not the optimal way to go. It's very, very rare in history of blockchain that you've been able to rent hardware and make a profit off it. So I started looking at, okay, what if I set up a NAS and like fill that with drives? And I think I did calculations based on buying the best value, like 8 terabyte drives or something, and having a couple hundred terabytes available. Basically, the system would pay off itself in 3 to 6 months, and then it would be like you'd make, you know, a couple hundred bucks a month.
Oh, that's not bad.
No, but it was like a $3,000-$4,000 investment upfront. Yeah. And then you gotta wait a really long time. And the question is, what happens in that time? Like 6 months from now, when I'm profitable, will the coin be worth less? Will, like, as with normal, like proof of work mining, the more some like other people join and start mining, the less profitable you are.
It's true.
So it's the same thing here. Like if a ton of people joined, I wouldn't actually, like, suddenly my payback isn't 3 or 6 months, it's 6 or 12 months. And it's this unpredictability in the market. And now if you're a believer, like if you're a true believer in this technology, you would say, well, the price of the coin is going to go up.
And that will make up for all of the work today. And yes, it might look like pennies now, but look at Bitcoin when it started and people, you know, didn't know what they were mining. They just thought they were doing it for fun.
Exactly. And now you were sitting in mining.
Bazillionaires.
Yeah. Bitcoin was 10 bucks and you got one Bitcoin a month and it was just 10 bucks a month and you were hardly paying for electricity bills.
Yeah.
Those people are laughing today. But the question is, like, will this happen?
Also, how many people mined shit altcoins that, like, went nowhere?
Right.
Probably
exactly.
Lots of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, and so this sort of like, maybe just wrap, like, how, so in the end, what was, like, did you like mining SIA? Do you think you would ever do it again?
I don't think so, no. I don't, like, there's many ways that I can make money in an easier way than buying a bunch of hard drives and putting them in a server. So for me personally, it's not that interesting, but I can see that it will be for a lot of people. Like it's a low barrier to entry. It's much lower barrier to entry, in fact, than proof of work mining. With Bitcoin, you need ASICs. With Ethereum, you need GPUs. Setting up a GPU rig is way, way more complicated. it's way more complicated to keep it running. It's way more costly to keep it running, noisy, and like it's just a hard thing to do. Whereas buying a bunch of drives and setting them in a server, we've been doing that for decades. Like that's an easy thing to do. So I can see that it would be attractive for a lot of people, especially people in regions where it's really cheap to buy drives.
And that sort of leads me to the sort of concluding question about all of these is, are they viable? From what you've just said, like maybe it becomes something that people really do, but it is like every decentralized technology, like most network effect driven concepts, you need to have a lot of people excited about it. You need to have a lot of people dedicated to it and people who will keep their machines running. And I think that's sort of what when I look across all of these different ideas or the different solutions, it's like, well, will people be excited enough past the sort of initial, like, oh, it's cool and I'm going to set up some sort of rig? And will they actually become regular users of this? Will this actually transform everything? And would it be a multitude of different tokens or will it be one?
Yeah.
I guess those are the questions.
It's a very good question. I think the vision of having like millions of nodes around the world in a well-distributed, you know, random-looking pattern, which is what you want for a CDN, it's not going to happen. Like there aren't enough people that are willing to kind of run this at home and do all of this stuff just for the sake of, I don't know, a couple of bucks. I mean, the coin value increase argument is an argument, but long term it isn't. Like the goal long term is for the value, like the price to reflect the value, and the value doesn't go up. Like, yeah. You know what I mean, it goes up a little bit the larger the network becomes. And so I think that vision is kind of weird. I don't really believe in it, but I do believe that it's here and it's going to stick around. The real question to make it like a thing, a proper thing, is if you can get companies to start using it. Because companies are the major users of storage solutions. Mm-hmm. Like, who uses S3 that isn't a company and isn't like a geek like me? Mm-hmm. I don't know. And like getting a company to say, I'm going to put my data on some random dude's computer at home. Like, I don't know. That's a long stretch. Like you need to have shown some really solid performance characteristics and like have solid guarantees in place for this. And even then, I don't know. I mean, so many data protection laws now that are saying that you're only allowed to store it in this region and you're only allowed to do this or that. And so this space will need to fight around all of that stuff.
I see two sort of like dystopic visions too. One is that like people just start like the Pied Piper model where you just start like forcing. I don't know if you know the reference, but like Silicon Valley. Spoiler alert, season 4, they basically like turn into decentralized storage on mobile, but it's like they basically force it like secretly on every phone in the region at this event. So it's like secretly your phone would basically be storing things, or secretly your computer would be storing things. So that's one. And the other is, and this is actually, I think it's happened for some people who are like in the kind of old P2P space, but like if you are holding data for other people and that data is in any way illegal or scary, yep. That somehow if they could trace back the fact that you are holding that thing, that you would be liable.
Yeah.
Maybe dystopia is a little bit of a stretch. It's not the biggest dystopia ever. These are like maybe two possible negative outcomes to this.
I think that's a valid problem. It's mitigated to some extent by encryption. So if it's end-to-end encrypted, you can never say what's stored on a computer. Like the computer mm-hmm. owner can't say what's stored on the computer. So you have like plausible deniability there, even if they do a trace route from the person uploading to wherever it's stored, like you could say, I have no idea what's being stored.
I have heard of cases where that didn't hold up, though.
So that's the thing. Like, laws are different in different regions, and it's all, like, yeah. I doubt that the, like, Chinese government would buy that, oh, I didn't know I was storing this propaganda. It's a tough problem. And I think all those fights need to be fought before this is anything that's viable mainstream. But before then, there will be a lot of users who just want to store their backups somewhere or like less critical things. There are tons of those things. And building a Dropbox on it or something, like if I lose my Dropbox, it's not the end of the world. It's like, whatever documents, my CV on there, whatever.
What about the Pied Piper model? We just force everybody to store everything all the time.
Yeah, that's it.
What if it was built into the devices?
Yeah. You would need then to have a player on this market that is willing to do that, which is essentially like Apple building it in or Microsoft building it into Windows. I think that's highly unlikely. They would have no reason to do it. But what will happen is what's happened with Bitcoin and other things that you can mine is that every website will start putting this software on their website. And so as long as you're on a website, it will be doing some storage in the background.
I think that's definitely maybe not to the extent that like there, you know, that there's these programs that are basically using up all of your empty space and providing decentralized storage out there, but that there's these sort of light versions of that where there's some slightly, not malicious, but like, you know, self-serving actor who's trying to force you to do it.
But I don't think that necessarily affects the network. So like websites mining Bitcoin hasn't affected the Bitcoin network. I don't think website storing would really affect the storage network. I mean, it's just recognized as something kind of tangentially related and evil. And so we need to find ways to stop that by, you know, the browser vendors making changes, essentially. Yeah. But it's not like, a destructive force in the network, I think.
Cool. Frederick, always a pleasure. Do you have any last thoughts on this?
The only last thoughts I would have is to say that I think it's an interesting problem space. I think it's something that we should all be looking into a little bit more than we are. And the only reason I say that is because Ethereum smart contracts and blockchain stuff is getting so much hype and so much attention. But the fact of the matter remains that you cannot build a decent application on Ethereum without some sort of storage. Like if you want it to be fully decentralized, if you're buying into this vision of having a world computer, you need world storage. Mm-hmm. You can't centralize your storage and be a decentralized application. So right now, people are just making compromises. But at some point, we have to ask ourselves, like, is it okay that we make these compromises? Maybe it is. But if we don't believe that it's okay and we do want a fully decentralized application structure, infrastructure, this is a key piece of it.
Hmm. What I'm realizing, and actually through our conversation, is that I agree with you, where I think it's one of the most, it's like this important character, this important piece of the decentralized future web, if that happens. But then when I go back to that idea of incentivization and potentially, you know, help, like having people hold data and then be funded and have this be something almost like a passive income, I think of it a bit like maybe it's a piece of a big kind of suite of services that you are providing somehow through, like storage could be one of them, streaming could be another, other kinds of proof of work, proof of whatever. You know, we can, when we look at the databases, we can also look at what their models are. But Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, my real takeaway is, like, maybe this is, like, a piece of that vision where, like, every human is kind of contributing something and every human is somehow being compensated for it.
Yeah, I mean, our digital lives are a huge part of our lives now, and it's getting bigger. So instead of centralizing all the digital service providers, if we were all digital service providers, we would all share in the profit of providing those services. I mean, I think that's an idealistic and great goal to go for. There are obviously more services than digital that the world needs, like growing food. But I think as the kind of digital world gets more and more important and bigger, and the industry around it gets bigger, if we can share in the profits, all the better.
Cool. Well, thanks again for the chat.
Thanks for listening.
See you guys next time.